Hi, everybody. My name is Oisin.
I'm Connor.
And I'm Dara.
And together we make up the Out of Ireland podcast. It's a light-hearted historical podcast about the many and varied Irish people who have left Ireland and gone on to do all sorts of things around the world.
We'll be looking at Irish people who were condemned as witches, led doomed expeditions, and both fought and became tyrants. And I'll also be trying my absolute best to annoy Dara with some pretty terrible jokes.
Even though we'll be covering some fairly serious topics, we'll always try and keep it a bit lighthearted. You can find us by searching the Out of Ireland podcast wherever you get your podcast. See you there.
It was a Saturday evening in the New Lodge area of Belfast. There was a jovial atmosphere in the Catholic-owned McGurk's pub. Outside the pub, a man appeared and placed a parcel at the entrance and then rushed back to their car before driving off. Moments later, a bomb exploded, causing the whole building to collapse. Within hours of the attack, the security forces and media began to wrongly say that this bombing was an IRA own goal. So who was really responsible? This is the Troubles Podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a bloody conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. The year is 1971 in Northern Ireland, and this is where things began to take a nosedive, and the levels of violence started to drastically increase. The British Army had been deployed in 1969, and though things had escalated throughout 1970, the relative amount of deaths was rather small, with 26 people being killed that year. In 1971, this number jumped to 171 people killed, with 89 of them being civilians, and the rest being police, army, or paramilitaries. Throughout 1971, the IRA were quite active, staging a number of bombing attacks on British Army and RUC officers. Then in August of that year, the British Army began Operation Demetrius, also known as Internment, which was an operation which saw the arrest of 342 people, mostly Catholics, who were suspected of being involved in the IRA. Of the 2,000 people that would eventually end up interned, it is estimated that just 100 of that figure were loyalists, so many Catholic civilians felt they were being singled out by the army. The British Army would eventually intern Loyalist paramilitaries, but not until 1973. The Prime Minister of Northern Ireland at the time, Unionist Brian Faulkner, believed that this operation would smash the IRA. Unfortunately, the intelligence used in making these arrests proved to be extremely faulty, and a large number of the people arrested had nothing to do with the IRA. The Catholic population felt very threatened by this policy, and it led to a very large Catholic and nationalist sense of alienation from the Unionist state. It also seriously ramped up the violence that had been steadily trickling away throughout the year. It was the evening of December 4th, 1971, when four members of the Loyalist paramilitary group, the Ulster Volunteer Force, or UVF, met up in the Shankill area of Belfast. They received a 23-kilogram gelignite bomb, which had been disguised as a brown parcel. It has then been reported that they were ordered to bomb a pub on North Queen Street in Belfast. The pub that was originally chosen was the Gem, which the UVF claimed had ties to the IRA. The bombers arrived at the Gem at 7:30 in the evening, but couldn't plant the bomb outside as there was a doorman at the bar. They waited for a while and then gave up, but they were under instructions not to return until the job was done, and were also beginning to worry as gelignite bombs could sometimes sweat. Sweating is when the nitroglycerin leaches out of the explosive mixture it's part of, where it pools and crystallizes, and those crystals can become very sensitive to shock or movement. The men drove to the nearest Catholic pub, which happened to be just around the corner, McGurk's Pub. It was owned by Patrick and Philomena McGurk, who lived above the pub with their four children. One of the men placed the bomb outside the pub at approximately 8:45 p.m. And as they were driving away, the bomb detonated.
above it didn't have a chance. The bomb exploded without any warning. The three-story building collapsed like matchwood into a pile of rubble, and almost as quickly that caught fire. Many of those killed died immediately, but others were trapped under tons of burning debris.
Bystanders rushed to the scene and began to pull people out of the ruins of the building, alongside firefighters and police. The rescue effort went on for many hours, with people forming a chain and passing bits of rubble along it until they found a survivor or body. Here's pub owner Patrick talking about the night.
I was in the public bar on that night, dispensing a drink about 8:45, and I'm looking around the bar to see where customers have been served there, having a look over towards the Great George Street door, and there seemed to be a flash outside it. And then all of a sudden, it was just an almighty bang, and the place just went into smithereens, and I was buried under the floor where I was drawing the drink. It wasn't long until I discovered that under the stillion, the wooden stillion, there was a fire starting, and the fire was just coming, the flames were coming towards me where I was lying there, and I tried to get up through, but there was timber and glass there, so I couldn't move. And then I was pulled out of the debris with just in the sock soles, and then I was taken out the ambulance.
Fifteen people were killed in the blast. Eight of those inside died from crush asphyxia, and five others from burns and carbon monoxide poisoning. Owner Philomena McGurk lost her life alongside her 14-year-old daughter Maria. 13-year-old James Francis Cromie was the youngest person to die in the bombing. Here's John McGurk, who was 10 at the time, talking about what he remembers.
I was 10 years of age. I was playing in the sitting room of our house. We lived above the bar. The sitting room was on the first floor. All I really seem to remember is that it was like something out of a really bad TV film or horror film. It was like being spun in the air and not knowing what was happening, and just this terrible whoosh and wind, and obviously I was plummeting through the air. I think the most difficult thing I probably remember about it is that I heard a young girl's voice very faintly crying for help, and then shouting my sister's name to see if she could hear me, thinking it was her, and then not hearing it. I've always wondered whether it was her.
Shortly after the bombing, violence erupted nearby, and the British Army and RUC engaged in a gun battle with Republicans. An army officer, Jeremy Shaw, was shot in the head and later died of his wounds. A number of RUC officers and civilians were also wounded in the gunfire. Directly after the bombing, Brian Faulkner issued a statement condemning the actions of the attackers, which read, quote, "The sight of that devastated building, which literally collapsed on its occupants, must surely arouse feelings of horror and revulsion in the mind of any sane person. Only an insane fanatic could place or even handle a gelignite bomb in premises crowded with ordinary civilians. The tragedy vividly demonstrates once more that the men of violence are a menace to us all in Northern Ireland, regardless of our political outlook. They bring nothing but death, suffering and fear. Whatever else divides us, we must unite, denounce and defeat the gunmen and bombers to rid our society of this deadly evil." Jerry Fitt was the leader of the SDLP party, and it was his constituency that was attacked. Here's him talking about the attacks.
The most heartbreaking sight that I have ever lived to see. I've represented this area now for 20 years. I was born and reared in the area. I've known, no doubt, when the names are published tomorrow or whenever they're published, I will know the vast majority of the people. I know the owner and his wife. The wife, I understand, is dead. As I say, it's heartbreaking. What can you say at a time like this? I have consistently condemned violence since the outbreak of violence in Northern Ireland, because I could see this happening. But this here is beyond ever anything that I ever expected to happen.
The bombing was also covered in many newspapers in Ireland, England and Northern Ireland. And there was one quote I found in one of the papers that I thought was very poignant, which read, The sorrow of one disaster was quickly drowned out by the thunder of the next. I'm now going to talk about some of the families of the victims. The following interviews are taken from the excellent documentary McGurk's Bar Bombing, Loss of Innocence, which was made by Kieran McGart. You can watch it on YouTube, and I'll make sure to leave a link in the show notes. Robert McClengagan lost his grandfather, Philip Gary, in the attack. He found out about the bombing while watching football on the television. The programme was interrupted by a special news bulletin, which then listed out the casualties, and Robert realised his grandfather was on the list. According to Robert, his mother started screaming, and his father jumped up out of his seat in sheer shock. Gerard Keenan lost both his mother and his father in the attacks, Edward and Sarah. In the documentary, Gerard explained that he was nearby the scene of the bombing and heard the bomb go off. Quote, "I went out the front door, seen people running about, blown about everywhere, and somebody started shouting, 'McGurk's, McGurk's.' The next thing I seen was complete chaos. It was just one complete pile of rubble, with hundreds of people on top of it, trying to tear it apart to save people." His father, Edward, was near a gas line which went on fire as the building collapsed, and his face was burnt as well as being crushed by the rubble. His mother, Sarah, was crushed to death from the building collapse. Gerard explained that there was a mix-up at the wake later on, and that they ended up having the wrong body. His father had a missing finger from an accident years ago, and the body that they were sent home with showed a hand with no fingers missing. Edward Keenan's body had been accidentally switched with the body of another victim, Thomas McLaughlin. Tommy McCready was the son-in-law of James Smith, described the conditions in the morgue, saying that amongst the bodies laid out, there were also parts of bodies. He explained in the documentary that he was able to identify the body of his father-in-law. He then went on to say that of the 15 people killed that night, only two were able to be displayed in an open coffin for their wakes. The rest of the bodies were too badly mutilated. Patricia Irvine, who was the daughter of Kathleen Irvine, who lost her life in the attack, described what happened when the body of her mother arrived home for the wake. She said, quote, "And the coffin came in, and my daddy says, 'Bite the lid,' but they wouldn't lift the lid off because my mother, as you know, she was burned alive. And just as they set the coffin down, the army came in straight into the door, demanding the coffin be lifted open because they were searching for guns and ammunition. They were trying to link someone that had been killed in the bomb to the IRA in order to prove that it was the IRA that done it." The funerals took place in twos and threes in the days following the bombings. The bodies were buried in Milltown Cemetery, and the funeral procession took the families past the area of Lower Shankill, which was a centre of loyalist activity. Robert describes that there was a famous song in the charts called Bits and Pieces. And as the funeral procession passed the Lower Shankill, the Unionist men and women were there singing lyrics of the song at the procession. Quote, "They were singing Bits and Pieces about my grandfather." In the immediate aftermath of the bomb, there was a distinct sense of confusion. The UVF had been actively bombing targets in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. But this no-warning bomb was on a different scale. 2 days after the bombing, on December 6th, a number of newspapers received a statement which read, "We, the Empire Loyalists, accept responsibility for the destruction of McGurk's pub. We placed £30 of new explosives outside the pub because we had proved beyond doubt that meetings of IRA provisionals and officials were held there." No one knew who the Empire Loyalists were, and it was suspected to be a cover name for the UVF. The security forces investigated the attack and quickly came to the conclusion that this was an IRA own goal, which meant that they were saying that this bomb accidentally detonated while the IRA were assembling it inside the bar. The media then began broadcasting this, and it soon gained momentum. Just 4 days after the bombing, the RUC released a report which read, quote, "At 8:45pm on Saturday 4th of December 1971, an explosion occurred at the McGurk's licensed premises, 83 Great George's Street. The charge was estimated at £50, completely demolished the two-storey building. Just before the explosion, a man entered the licensed premises and left down a suitcase, presumably to be picked up by a known member of the Provisional IRA. The bomb was intended for use on other premises. Before the pickup was made, the bomb exploded. This statement gathered more momentum, and when the bombing was discussed in Parliament in Northern Ireland just a few days later, John Taylor, who was the Minister for State Home Affairs, said, quote, "The plain fact is that the evidence of the forensic experts supports the theory that the explosion took place within the confines of the walls of the building." On December 14th, the British Ministry of Defence drafted a report saying, "The forensic evidence now available shows quite clearly that five of the victims were killed by the blast, indicating that the explosion must have been inside the bar, and raising the very strong presumption that it was caused by accidental detonation of a bomb being carried by one of the customers, as has seemed likely all along." Prime Minister Brian Faulkner met with the British Home Secretary shortly after the bombing, where he reiterated these points and went on to say that the bomb went off on the ground floor and that there were no strangers in the bar on the night of the explosion. These accusations are quite damning. It changes the narrative of what happened. On the night, the pub was full of innocent Catholic civilians who were enjoying a night out. The narrative that was presented by the RUC and media was that this pub was a hub of IRA activity, and that the IRA were in there working on a bomb when it blew up and killed them and the Catholic civilians around them. This accusation was deeply, deeply upsetting to the families of the victims. The problem was that throughout the course of the investigation, there was very little proof to substantiate the claims that a bomb was being assembled inside the pub. In fact, a British Army bomb expert made a log stating that they believed that the bomb was placed in the entrance of the pub on the ground floor, as that is where the crater was. As well as that, there were splinters found in the bodies of some of the victims, which showed that the bomb exploded outside the door of the bar and blasted wooden splinters into the victims who were inside. The victims were also tested for traces of explosives, and none were found. On top of that, there was also a witness outside the bar who saw the bomb being planted. 8-year-old Joseph McClory was outside McGurk's when he saw a man plant the bomb and light the fuse, before jumping into a car and speeding off. He then saw a person who was about to go into the bar and said, quote, "Mister, don't go into that bar, there's a bomb there," end quote. Joseph then saw the car speed off and saw a Union Jack sticker on the back of the car. But this statement wasn't accepted by the police until years later. In 1976, the RUC received intelligence related to the bombing that linked a man named Robert James Campbell to the attack. No action was taken, but in 1977 he was arrested. Campbell was a loyalist paramilitary and was suspected of being involved in a completely unrelated shooting. But during his interrogation, he confessed to membership of the UVF and also went on to outline his role in the McGurk's bar bombing. It was from this interrogation that the details emerged of the circumstances surrounding the attack, where Campbell was told to leave and not return unless the job was done. He admitted that he was in the car on the night of the attack, but refused to name any of his four co-conspirators. He appeared in court on July 29, 1977, charged with 15 murders and 17 attempted murders. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to serve life imprisonment, with a recommendation to serve no less than 20 years. Campbell was released in 1993 after serving 15 years of his sentence. The most recent Police Ombudsman report was released in February 2011. The report was reluctant to say the word collusion, but instead said that there had been an investigative bias on the part of the RUC. There had also been lingering allegations that there was collusion between the security forces and the bombers, as there had been checkpoints set up around the streets of Belfast on the evening of the attack, which were apparently removed an hour before the attack. The report stated that there was no evidence of collusion in this case. The report also found that the RUC did not make adequate contact with the families in the aftermath of the attacks. The RUC failed to communicate with the families of those who were killed, which led to a sense of mistrust between families and the security forces. The IRA own goal theory was also completely discredited, and it is unclear who exactly started spreading this theory and the police rationale behind it. The report also found that the police failed to give adequate consideration to loyalist paramilitaries when investigating the attack. There's a few more points, but to sum it up, the report says that because the RUC were quick to assume that this attack was an IRA attack, it prevented an effective, unbiased investigation from taking place. The RUC also gave selective and misleading reports to the media and government, which further hindered the investigation. John McGurk, who lost his mother, sister, and uncle in the attack, actually met with Robert James Campbell at Campbell's home in 2011. John hoped it would help give him some sense of closure and spoke of seeing pictures on the walls of Robert's home with sons and grandchildren. And he thought, quote, "I reflected on how he had robbed all the families of the McGurk's Bar bombing with one of life's most precious pleasures." John wanted Campbell to tell him about who else was involved in the bombing, but Campbell refused, saying, "Unfortunately, I can do nothing to help all those poor people, and all I can say is sorry. Sorry is only a wee word, but it means a whole lot, you know. That's all I can do for you, boss." John said of the meeting, "I witnessed an old man apologize to me over and over again, but refused to say more about what happened." Today, the families of the victims are still actively campaigning for justice for their loved ones and for the remaining bombers to be named. The most recent developments in this case happened in March 2021, as the families of those killed in McGurk's Bar have launched legal proceedings against the police ombudsman. Patrick McGurk, the owner of the pub, died at the age of 86 in 2007. He was a devout Catholic and gave a television interview shortly after the bombing. On the screen he appeared, badly bruised. He had just lost his wife and daughter in the attacks, and he appealed for there to be no retaliation. He forgave those who attacked the bar and prayed for the men who carried out the atrocity. That's it for me. See you next time. If you would prefer an ad-free version of the podcast, you can get that over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. Over there, I'll also be posting videos and media related to the Troubles. If you'd like to support the podcast in a once-off fashion, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/troublespodcast. You can also support the podcast by leaving reviews or by simply telling your friends. It all helps.